Today is July 1st, 2015. This is the Small Towns Project. My name is Eric Leachy, and I'm here with Jim Kopelman, and we are in his office in Natrona Heights. And we're going to be talking about New Kensington. So why don't you start by telling me how your family got to New Kensington?
Well, first of all, let me start by telling you my full name.
Okay.
And my full name is Osher Hanan Ben Nochen Zalman.
Good.
And my father was Nochen Zalman Ben Chaim Yeruchim, and my mother was Fredel Bet Shmuel. And I was born in the McGee Hospital in Pittsburgh, in the Oakland section of Pittsburgh, on December 23rd, 1940. And I came home to what my lifelong home would be, and that is New Kensington, when I was 1 week old. And except my time at school, I have lived in the New Kensington area all of my life. Now, when we talk about New Kensington, that is really a generic word for New Kensington, Arnold, and Lower Borough, which are three third-class cities in Westmoreland County that are all contiguous to one another. And unless you are a surveyor, you would not be able to determine when you left one city and came to the next. So as I talk about the Jewish community of New Kensington, I'm going to talk about its birth, I'm going to talk about its vibrancy, and I'm also going to talk about its demise. Because as far as I know, there are probably only three or four Jewish families left in the New Kensington area. And this, at its peak in the 40s and the 50s, in terms of families, we had a congregation of probably 150 or 160 families. And our congregation was called Beth Jacob Congregation. And I will give you in my discussion the history of how the congregation was formed, the various buildings that they occupied, and what has become of the congregation today. So let's begin at the beginning, because the history of New Kensington was intertwined inextricably with the history of the Jewish community in New Kensington. So let us begin in the year 1856. In the year 1856, there was a young Scotch-Irishman by the name of Stephen Young, and he packed up gold in his saddlebags in Pittsburgh and rode by horse up the northern side of the Allegheny River to purchase a farm of rich Allegheny River bottom land of 100 and some acres. And Mr. Young purchased this farm and subsequently built a large brick house on what would now be 7th Street and 3rd Avenue in the city of New Kensington. Now, some years after that, at Oberlin College in 1888, a young chemist by the name of Charles Martin Hall discovered a method to extract alumina from bauxite. And alumina, A-L, if you're a chemist, is aluminum. And it soon became clear that his invention had very good potential from an entrepreneurial point of view. And accordingly, Charles Martin Hall teamed up with Captain Alfred Hunt and the Mellon family and started a small plant on Smallman Street in 1888, a few blocks below the 40th Street Bridge. It became apparent by 1890 that for Hall's invention to have any great economic impact on his two investor entrepreneurs, that they would need to expand into much larger quarters than what the Smallman Street area in Pittsburgh provided. And as a result, the Mellon family bought from the successors of the Stephen Young family about 90% of the Young farm. And they formed a company called the Burrell Improvement Company that purchased most of this farm. The Burrell Improvement Company laid out a plan of lots, which essentially was the town of Kensington. And they recorded this plan of lots in the Westmoreland County Courthouse Recorder of Deeds Office in Plan Book Volume 1, page 10. In other words, there were only 9 pages of recorded plans ahead of this one in Westmoreland County. And in this plan, they set aside the river areas for industrial usage, and then they set up a grid plan for residential and commercial usage. And in 1891, the Pittsburgh Reduction Works, which was the predecessor company to the Aluminum Company of America and then Alcoa, moved from Smallman Street to New Kensington. And they also had a lot sale in New Kensington, and they gave free trips on the Pennsylvania Railroad to New Kensington on Sundays for people to buy lots. And these people anticipated that they would work for the Pittsburgh Reduction Works, and they would be in walking distance. Now, in 1856, the Allegheny Valley Railway came through the farm, the Young farm, and went all the way to Katanning. So this area was serviced by rail, and of course, New Kensington was on the Allegheny River. There seems to be some dispute as to whether the borough of New Kensington was incorporated by petition to the Court of Common Pleas of Westmoreland County in 1891 or 1892, and I have never bothered to research that. But I had a personal connection with the city government of New Kensington from the time I graduated from the Pitt Law School in 1966 until I quit my municipal practice in 2013. So a good part of my legal career was involved with the government of the city of New Kensington along with other areas of my law practice. I graduated from the public schools of New Kensington, attended Dickinson College, then went to Pitt Medical School, and then Pitt Law School, graduating in 1966. So, Alcoa, formerly the Reduction Company, but more commonly called the Company in New Kensington, got started in the last decade of the 19th century. And, of course, with the foresight of the Mellon family, who owned the Burl Improvement Company, they sold lots to their employees. And with a quickly growing population, because of the industrial expansion of the late 19th century and the early 20th century, New Kensington was one of the fastest growing towns in not only the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, but the United States of America. And at its peak, New Kensington had 28,000 people. Arnold had 10,000 people, and Lower Burl had 8,000 people. So, naturally, in a growing industrial area, this would attract a merchant class. And the first Jew to come to New Kensington, who was also a Litvak, meaning that his origins were in Lithuania, was Isaac Klaster in 1892. And quickly followed in that last decade of the 19th century were the Fisher family, the Miller family, the Kopelman family, and the Myers family. Those families are not, I did not list them in chronological order because I know the Millers were here before the Kopelmans, which were my family, but I'm not sure of the chronological order. All of those families eventually became merchants. And I think that this merchant class, and all of them were Litvaks. They had come from Lithuania. Also in that last decade of the 19th century was the Sokolsky family, but the Sokolskys came from Poland.
The Sokolskys were Jewish?
Yes. The Sokolskys were Jewish as well. My grandfather came to New Kensington in 1898, and his name, as I mentioned, was Chaim Yeruchim, Hyman, and he spelled his name not H-Y-M-A-N, although I have seen his name on legal documents that way, but he spelled it more like Haman, H-A-I-M-A-N, and he came here in 1898 because his brother Max Kopelman was already here. Now, in some records, Max was supposed to have come in 1892 to New Kensington, but my father told me that he thought Uncle Max came in 1895, so that remains a mystery. But the Kopelmans came from a small shtetl in Lithuania called Vasilishuk. And Vasilishuk today in modern Lithuania is known as Wasilewski. And my father was born sometime around Hanukkah in the year 1897. But apparently they were never quite sure when my father's birthday was. And I suppose if they had gone back and seen when Hanukkah was in 1897, they could have figured it out. But over the years, I saw papers with Metropolitan Life Insurance that said that he was born on December 1st, 1897. I saw other papers that said December 8th. But for some reason or other, he decided to celebrate his birthday on Frank Sinatra's birthday, which was December 12th, of 1897. My father's discharge papers from World War I also had a different date. So that will remain a mystery of history, but I don't really think it is of any great moment. The idea was that my grandfather would come to New Kensington, where his brother Max was, and make enough money to send for my grandmother and my father, who when he came in 1900 was 3.5 years old, and my Uncle Ellis, who was 5.5 years old. Of note to Steeler fans, my Uncle Ellis had a son, Myron Copelman, whose name was changed to Myron Cope at the suggestion of Al Abrams, who was the sports editor of the Post-Gazette, because cousin Myron went to Pitt as a journalism major, was the sports editor of the Pitt News, later went to work for the Post-Gazette, went on to write for the Saturday Evening Post and Sports Illustrated, and ended up as a color broadcaster for the Pittsburgh Steelers for 30-some years, and invented the Myron Cope's terrible towel, the orange and black towel that to this day has mystical powers with respect to Steeler football success. Well, anyway, after my grandfather came to New Kensington from Vasilishuk, my grandmother waited at home for him to send money back. And it turns out that the first money my grandfather sent back to Vasilishuk was not to his wife Hannah. He sent it to his mother because he had a sister, Zelda, and my great-grandmother was a widow. She was widowed very early in her married life, and they only had 3 children, the daughter Zelda, Uncle Max, and my grandfather, Chaim Yeruchim. And because my grandmother was poor, and they had a daughter to marry off, and the custom in those days was that when your daughter married, she brought with her a dowry to the marriage. And my poor widowed great-grandmother had no money for a dowry to marry off her daughter. So as a result, that was the first money my grandfather sent back. So this greatly irritated my grandmother. And you have to understand my grandmother and my grandfather's relationship in Vasilishuk. Number one, I was shocked to read in a 75th anniversary book that the Beth Jacob congregation, the congregation in New Kensington, put out. And they interviewed my father, and I never knew this because my father never discussed it, but he told the whole world in that 75th anniversary book, which I believe the History Center has as part of its archives. He told the whole world, and I had to find out secondhand, that my grandparents had an arranged marriage in Vasilishuk. I believe in Yiddish it was called a shidduch. And the way the marriage was arranged, my grandmother came from a family of means. And my grandfather's family really had nothing, but he was yeshiva educated. And since he was a learned man, that was a good marriage between money and learning. So anyway, apparently my grandmother scraped together $500 in 1900, which, if you stop to think about it, was a lot of money. And she took her 3.5-year-old son and my Uncle Ellis, whose name in Hebrew was Eliyahu, Elijah, and went steerage class through the port of Baltimore with a sign pinned on her coat that she was to come to New Kensington, Pennsylvania, and somehow or other, with the grace of God, whose countenance must have shined upon her, she ended up at the railroad station in New Kensington on what in those days was called Station Street, today is called Barnes Street. And they saw this poor Jewish woman. And I never knew my grandmother because she died in 1938, but I'm told that she only stood 4 feet 11 or 5 feet tall with these two babies in hand. And they took her to the Davis-Miller house. Now, as I said, the Davis-Millers also came to New Kensington in the first in the last decade of the 19th century. Davis Miller had a small shoe store, and his family lived upstairs. And Davis Miller not only sold ready-made shoes, but he also was a shoemaker, a trade that he had learned in Lithuania. And by a shoemaker, I don't mean somebody that puts new soles and new heels on shoes. I mean somebody that takes a piece of leather and makes you a pair of shoes. So Mrs. Miller, whose name was Annalena Miller, Davis's wife, made lunch for my grandmother and my father and my uncle and explained to her that my grandfather was a pack peddler, and that meant that he had merchandise and he would go door to door and knock on the door and see if he could sell something to people. And she explained to him that he was living with his brother and his wife on Fifth Avenue above 11th Street, behind where the New Kensington Post Office is today. That whole area was redeveloped by the city of New Kensington. All those houses were knocked down. I was both over the years, the chairman of the New Kensington Redevelopment Authority and also the solicitor at various times for the New Kensington Redevelopment Authority. So a good portion of early New Kensington, where the early Jews lived as immigrants, has been totally torn down by redevelopment. But shortly after my grandmother got here, my grandfather went from being a pack peddler and a very fromm, very religious person. And I remember even as a small boy, because my grandfather was so fromm and yeshiva trained, that some of the older Jews would tip their hat to him in the synagogue and call him Rev, which was a mark of respect for his Jewish learning. But with my grandmother here, and according to my father, my grandmother was the businesswoman. My grandfather was more tied up in what we call tzedakah, charity, and my grandmother made the money and my grandfather gave it away. But in any event, in 1906, after my grandmother got here and took charge of the family finance, they bought a lot from Andrew W. Mellon, who was the president of the Burl Improvement Company, and that lot was on the corner, is on the corner still, of 4th Avenue and 11th Street. With the they built a yellow brick building, and they had a general department store on the first floor, and they lived on the second floor. After my grandmother and grandfather got back together again in 1900, I often wondered if my grandfather did not send for her because he had a girlfriend. But that was speculation because they had 4 more children after my grandmother came to New Kensington, and they lived happily ever after. But it was interesting to note that just about all of the early settlers in New Kensington became merchants. And more than 50% of the early settlers in New Kensington were Litvaks, with a few Hungarians and a few Polish intervened. Most of the Hungarians started grocery stores. Most of the Litvaks had clothing stores or general department stores. But the interesting thing about it was that, you know, they say the Jews are the people of the book. And I don't know whether it was because of the education that the Litvaks had in Lithuania, because we all know that Vilna was the center of Jewish learning in the 19th century and before. But most of these immigrants made certain that their children got a college education. And these Litvaks, a few of their children followed in their parents' footsteps as merchants, but most of them became educated. In my own family, my father went to Jefferson Medical School and became a medical doctor, graduating at the top of his class in the year 1921. So within 21 years, he came with my grandmother and my Uncle Ellis through the port of Baltimore, and they came steerage class. And that was quite a trip. I never researched where they left from in Europe, but I do know they came through the port of Baltimore because my father told me that. And my father always warned me that when my wife and I went on a cruise, get the highest up in the ship that you can, because we were seasick for the couple of weeks that it took us the whole time. And he said, of course, our meal primarily consisted of bread and salami. And after a while, it was stale bread and salami, because the steamship companies sold food, or food was considered part of the passage, but that food was treif. It was non-kosher. So we couldn't eat any of that food. So he told me, when he still remembered, when they got to the Miller family house, store downstairs, residential part upstairs, which was the custom in those days, he got a good meal for the first time in 2 or 3 weeks. My father had very few memories of Vasilishuk because he was only 3.5 years old. But his main memory of Vasilishuk was market day. And market day in Vasilishuk was when all the peasants came in from the surrounding areas, and the Jews, the Yehudim, if you will, they had big doors on the front of their house that flipped up, and they had a counter behind these doors, and they would sell their wares to the peasants. And that was always a big day and a day of celebration. And Market Day was as big a celebration as Shabbos was, as they called it in the dialect of the Ashkenazim. And today, since we use Sephardic Hebrew, the Shabbat. So that was his main memory. But it's quite amazing when you stop and think about it. I'm first generation on my father's side. And here is somebody who comes steerage class. His first language is Yiddish. Of course, he quickly learned English and never had an accent. But within 21 years, he became a physician at the top of his class. And there were four girls in my father's family. One burnt to death in 1913, playing with another friend in front of a fireplace, and the sparks came out and she of the fireplace, and she burnt to death. But there were three other girls, and all three of those girls became school teachers, and they taught in the Arnold school system. My Uncle Ellis, who was the oldest of the six children and who was a brilliant man, just wasn't interested in going to college. He certainly was offered the opportunity. And that lack of education he paid for the rest of his life. His last job, as I remember, the last 20 years of his working life was as a insurance salesman for Metropolitan Life Insurance, where he would go door to door and collect a debit every week. And that was a hard way to make a living. But all of these people had an education. Now, it's very interesting if you look at the culture of New Kensington. New Kensington was like a micro United Nations. And that is to say, because they had mills, and while New Kensington was a company town for Alcoa, they also had General Electric. They had Pittsburgh Plate Glass, started their first plant directly across the river in Creighton. They had what they called the upper tin mill and the lower tin mill. Arnold had what we called the glass house, which started out as Chambers Glass Company and became American Saint Gobain. And so there was an awful lot of industry in New Kensington. So they needed workers to populate these industries. Plus, we had coal mines. Everything in New Kensington is undermined. And so we had all these immigrants coming from Eastern Europe, Slavish and Polish and Croatian, and from Southern Europe, Italians, and we had Russians, and all of these groups. Oh, and we had Arabic, we had Syrians, and I could go on and on. But all of these groups in the beginning of the 20th century were very insular, and they all formed their own organizations. There was the Italian-American Club. There was the Slovak Club. And there was the Jewish Club. And the Jewish Club had various locations in New Kensington. It was always above a storeroom. And they rented a second floor of a storeroom that previously had been used as a living quarters. And then the merchant became more successful and bought a house. And the Jewish Club, just like any of these other ethnic clubs, because let's face it, the Jews not only were a religious group, But for the most part, they were an ethnic group, too. And at night, the Jewish men, and it was purely a man's club, would meet up there, and they always had corned beef in the refrigerator, and they would have beer, and they would have whiskey, schnapps, as they called it. And they would sit up there, and they would play cards, and they would fraternize. And in the early days of the Jewish club, the language of the club was Yiddish. In the later years, the language of the club was English, but probably 60 or 70% of the latter members could still speak Yiddish. And as I recall, the Jewish club sort of disintegrated in the late 50s or early 60s. But let's talk about the real center of Jewish life in New Kensington, and that was the synagogue. And the synagogue was the Beth Jacob Synagogue. And if I recall correctly, the synagogue was incorporated as a nonprofit corporation in 1908. But before that time, before there was a formal nonprofit corporation called Beth Jacob Synagogue, there was a loosely constructed society of Jews in New Kensington. And by the end of the last decade of the 19th century, there probably were 15 or 20 Jewish families in New Kensington, and there was enough Jews for a minyan. And on the high holidays, the Jews would rent a second floor of a store to hold high holiday services, and the most prominent place that they rented was a place called Blosier's Meeting Hall, B-L-O-S-E-R, apostrophe S, which was upstairs of Blosier's Jewelry Store in the 900 block of 4th Avenue. There was no rabbi at that time. Many of the services were led by my grandfather because he was yeshiva trained and he could do all of the service off by heart without even looking at the prayer book. But other people led the services as well. In 1908, there were enough Jews that they decided to form a synagogue. And I know that my grandfather was one of the incorporators because I did see those original papers. And as one would expect, Isaac Claster, the first Jew in New Kensington, became the president of the Beth Jacob congregation. Shortly after that, in about 1913, a member of the Jewish community died. And actually, I think it was someone's relative who was visiting from out of town, but I can't remember the name. And so the leaders of the Jewish community, of which my grandfather was one, decided that they needed to have a cemetery. So they bought a tract of land on Craigdale Road in New Kensington, and they formed a separate corporation called Chebra Kadisha, Chebra Kadisha Cemetery. Now, the literal translation of Chebra Kadisha is burial society, but they chose the name of their corporation to be Chebra Kadisha, and my Aunt Mary Copelman, who died in the fire at 13 years of age in 1916, was one of the early people buried in the cemetery. The Chevra Kadisha Cemetery is on a hillside, just like the Mount of Olives Cemetery is on a hillside in Jerusalem. And the reason for that is the old-timers believed that you wanted to be buried in a place where the water would drain off of your grave. So the best graves in the Chevra Kadisha Cemetery are up at the top of the hill. So my Aunt Mary is buried up there, and my grandparents are buried up there. My parents and my wife's lots are down at the bottom, because my father told me as an old man, he said, "We're going to buy lots at the bottom so you don't have to schlep up to the top." He said, "I'm getting too old at 85 to schlep up to the top of the hill to make the Emoli Rachamim." So, and as I continue here, I will give you the history of the cemetery. So, as Alcoa, as the aluminum company prospered as an industry, so the town of New Kensington prospered. And because the town of New Kensington prospered, Jews, being the industrious, intelligent people that they are, and I realize that's an ethnocentric comment, but I'm still going to make it, New Kensington attracted a Jewish community. And the Jewish community, for the most part, at the beginning of the 20th century, were all merchants. The two main streets in New Kensington and Arnold were 4th Avenue and 5th Avenue. And I can go down 5th Avenue and up 4th Avenue, and in my mind's eye, I can tell you that probably 65% of the stores were owned by Jews.
Do you remember the names?
Yes. Of course, on 5th Avenue, on one side of the street, you had, well, on both sides of the street, you had Archie Miller, who had a clothing store with his brother, David Miller and Max Miller. Now, their father was Bayra Meir Miller. And Bayra Meir came here at the turn of the 20th century because his brother Davis Miller was already here. Davis Miller was the shoe man that I mentioned. Now, Bayra Meir was a farmer when he came here, and they lived on 3rd Avenue. And he rented a farm on Freeport Road until 1927 from the Ross family. And I heard many stories. You would see Bayra Meir taking his cows from his house on 3rd Avenue up to the farm early in the morning. In 1927, the Ross family sold that farm to Alcoa, and Alcoa built the largest light metals research laboratory in the world, where Bayra Meir raised his cows. Now, then there was Zinnemann's jewelry store, Abe Zinnemann, who my father affectionately called Ziny, had a jewelry store there. We had Fisher's, and Fisher's had a department store. We had Miller Brothers, which was Davis Miller's two sons, had the largest shoe store probably in western Pennsylvania. We had Camp Shoe Store, that was owned by the Slomoffs. And interestingly enough, There was only one Jewish person that I ever knew that worked in the mill at Alcoa. Now, Alcoa employed at its peak 8,500 people in New Kensington, and that included engineers and scientists at the research laboratories. There was only one mill worker, and that was Sam Slomoff, and that was the Slomoff's father, who started a chain of shoe stores called Camp Shoe Stores. Now, we also had Adolph Shoe Store. That was Adolph Beagle. We had Fintech's clothing store. That was Manny Sparks ran that. The largest department store in New Kensington was Silverman's Department Store. And the Silvermans were also Litvox. And they came from Dunbar, PA, about 1917, and opened a Silverman's Department Store on the corner of 4th Avenue and 11th Street. The two sons, the father ran the store, and then the two sons, Oscar and Sidney. Now, Sidney Silverman was an attorney, and he was a member of the Westmoreland Bar Association. But Sidney never really practiced law, because once he got out of law school, the department business was so lucrative that he couldn't afford to practice law. And then we had Siegel's Department Store, and we had Igas's Department Store. Julius Igas' son, it's interesting to note, became a vice president of National Broadcasting Company, and he was the second or third in command at NBC. Julius Igas was also a Litvak. The Silvermans were Litvaks. Meyer Hart had the second largest department store. I think Meyer might have been Polish. And my wife in later years worked for his son as their dress buyer. Bud Hart had 14 branch stores. He expanded from the original Hart's department store, and my wife worked for them and went to New York once a month to buy dresses. It's interesting to note that Bud Hart was the valedictorian of his high school class in 1937, and then went on to the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania to learn business, worked for a department store in New York for 2 or 3 years, and then came back to New Kensington and really made Hart's Department Store grow into a very large 14-branch store business. And we had Mr. Vendig, who had a children's shop. In the old days, there were enough Jews in New Kensington that we had Cayman's, our own delicatessen, on 5th Avenue, where you could go in at lunchtime and get a corned beef sandwich and a slice of a kosher dill pickle. And those are just a few of the merchants that I can think of. Oh, I can't forget Abe Wolfson. Abe Wolfson had the most high-class men's clothing store because he sold Hickey Freeman suits, and those were the best suits in his day. And Abe was sort of a genius. My father told me that he remembered about 1916, when electric lights came in, that Abe Wolfson wired the old synagogue and converted them from gas lights to electric lights. Now, in the first, right after Beth Jacob was incorporated in 1908, they built a synagogue on in the 1100 block of 3rd Avenue in New Kensington. And just to give you a feel, there was no 1st Avenue in New Kensington because that's where the industrial area was. The next street was 2nd. I'm going from the river north. And then the next street was 3rd Avenue, 4th Avenue, and so forth. So New Kensington had this synagogue. It was originally a frame synagogue, but I had seen pictures in later years of the synagogue, and it was sold. And it was a brick structure, but I can only think that that was a brick veneer that was put on the building later. My father was one of the early, or maybe the first, bar mitzvah in the synagogue. But my dad explained to me that being bar mitzvah was not a big deal back at the turn of the last century. He said he remembers that my grandmother baked kichel and brought some schmaltz herring, and my grandfather bought a bottle of rye whiskey. And that was the luncheon after the bar mitzvah. It bears no rational relationship to the way we celebrate a bar or a bat mitzvah today. But anyway, as the town prospered, and the prospering of Alcoa attracted many Jews to open all of these businesses, so did the synagogue prosper. And in the 1920s, it was decided that the old synagogue on Third Avenue was no longer large enough. Nor was it satisfactory, because by the 20s, as the Jewish merchant class prospered, they all moved up on the hill. They moved out of the downtown flat area. So it was decided that a lot be purchased at 1020 Kenneth Avenue, New Kensington. That lot was between McCargo Street and Walnut Street, and a grand new synagogue was built in the 20s. Now, that synagogue was of yellow brick construction. Nobody thought of the Americans with Disabilities Act in those days, and nobody thought about accessibility. So the synagogue was built on a hill, and it was three stories, and it had a balcony in the main sanctuary. And in those days, the synagogue was still Orthodox, and the women sat upstairs in the balcony, and the men sat on the first floor. And when the new synagogue was built, the seats were sold in the new synagogue. And the closer to the east that you got, the closer to the bima that you got, the more valuable the seats. And we had the seats, thanks to my grandfather, in the first row. So we were, so you couldn't sneak out, because you were right in front of the bima if you wanted to sneak out. And then in the late 50s and early 60s, as the community was at its peak and Alcoa was at its peak, and we had a second generation of Jews who were at the peak of their economic success. These were the people that came back from World War II, the educated people, people whose parents either sent them to college or they went to college on the GI Bill. But New Kensington was such a thriving community that they all came back here. We had doctors, we had lawyers, we had dentists, we had everything at that point. And so it was decided to build a big addition to the synagogue. And we had a Jewish architect, fortunately, in town by the name of Harold Schwartz. And we had a Jewish contractor in town by the name of Isidore Frank. And so between Harold Schwartz designing and totally remodeling everything except the sanctuary. We got a much larger social hall, more classrooms and everything. And so we had a real first-class synagogue in New Kensington. Now, let's talk a little bit about the relationship of the Jewish community with the community at large. I only experienced in my formative years one example of anti-Semitism all through high school. I knew that I was different primarily because on Tuesdays and Thursdays up until my bar mitzvah, instead of walking home from school with all my classmates, I had to walk to the shul to go to cheder. 2 hours. 2 hours Tuesday, 2 hours on Thursday. But other than that, and I also knew that I had to stomach the indignity of listening to the New Testament half of the time before we started our classes in the morning. We started our classes in the New Kensington School District from the first grade through the 12th grade with the teacher reading the Bible and then saying the Lord's Prayer and pledging allegiance to the flag. And I knew, I'm not sure how I knew, that when the New Testament was read, which was half the time, and half the time the Old Testament was read, that I tuned out when the New Testament was read. And when I had Miss Miller as my third grade teacher, who was Davis Miller's daughter, the shoe man, we only heard the Old Testament, so that was better. But that was only in the third grade. But I only had one instance of being treated badly on the basketball court where somebody by the name, well, I don't think I should mention the name, but his father was a German immigrant, and I think he might have been born in Germany, and his father came here as a scientist to work at the Alcoa Research Laboratories. And there was a very mean incident between this boy and myself on the basketball court in high school. And I really did not know about anti-Semitism growing up. But I always wondered, now why was this kid so mean to me? It wasn't until I got to college that I realized there was a thing called anti-Semitism. Because we were a United Nations in New Kensington. We had all these different nationalities. We had all these different religions. We all got along together. We were all friends. I didn't realize how the world worked until I got to college. But let me tell you how the world worked in New Kensington. And I really didn't realize that either till I became older. The way the world worked was, in New Kensington, Alcoa had this research laboratory that employed 1,600 scientists and technicians. There was not one Jew hired by Alcoa. Alcoa had all of these engineers that ran this plant, this aluminum plant that employed 8,500 people. There was not one Jewish engineer that worked for Alcoa. Now, query, was there not a Jewish chemist or a Jewish engineer or a Jewish physicist, out of 1,600 laboratory employees and 8,500 mill employees that would have been qualified to work for Alcoa? Well, obviously, I think we know the answer to my query, and we understand what the culture, the corporate culture, was at Alcoa through most of their existence in New Kensington. And to my knowledge, the only large company in Western Pennsylvania that did not have this culture was Westinghouse Electric Company. And Westinghouse is where all of the Jewish scientists and engineers seemed to congregate, and they were overly statistically represented because of Westinghouse. You might want to call it liberal policy, but I will call it intelligent policy. So, also, you have to understand, while we had this large merchant class in New Kensington, most of whom were very successful from an economic standpoint, they all had to put their money in the banks. They had to borrow money once in a while to pay for their inventory. We had two main banks in New Kensington. The first bank was the First National Bank in New Kensington, which was taken over by PNC. And we had the Logan Trust Company that was taken over by Mellon Bank. Neither one of these banks ever had a Jewish member on their boards. However, it's also interesting to note that my grandfather, when the Chambers Glass Company had a company department store in Arnold, it was called the Arnold Traffic Company, and they went broke in 1914. My grandfather was asked to take over that store, which he did, and he had the largest department store in Arnold. They also had a store in New Kensington, as I said, at the corner of 4th Avenue and 11th Street, which would have been a block and a half from where the old synagogue was. So the Logan Trust got the idea that they should open two branch banks. They should open a bank where Silverman's department store was on the corner of 4th Avenue and 9th Street, and they should put a gentleman by the name of Steiner in charge of that bank, who was Jewish. And that would cement the so-called ethnic trade for that bank. That bank, unfortunately, met its demise because Mr. Steiner embezzled from the bank, and the bank failed. They also decided that they should have a bank in Arnold because there were no banks in Arnold. And since my grandfather was the largest merchant in Arnold, they came to him and they said, "Mr. Copelman, because my grandfather dealt at the Logan Trust Company, they said, we're going to start a bank in Arnold that we're going to call the Arnold Deposit Bank. And we're going to need a board of directors, and you have to own 10 shares in the bank to be on the board of directors. Therefore, the shares are $100 apiece. If you don't have $1,000, we'll lend you the $1,000. We want you to buy 10 shares of stock and be on the board of directors." So my grandfather gave him $1,000. He didn't have to borrow it, and he was on the board of directors. Outside of the Steiner Bank that failed, my grandfather, to my knowledge, was the only Jew in New Kensington, Armour, or Lower Borough that was ever on the board of directors of a bank. The so-called better jobs were always held for the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants with a few Irish Catholics. That was the way the system worked. When my father graduated from Jefferson Medical School in 1921, he took his residency for a year, came back to Arnold, and my grandfather built him a building next to his department store for his son, the doctor. My father had a question mark in his mind whether he would be admitted to the staff of the Citizens General Hospital, because there had never been a Jewish doctor in New Kensington before. But since my grandfather had this large department store, there wasn't any question, and he was admitted to the medical staff. He was the chief of the medical staff for about 25 years, and as time went on, New Kensington was populated with a number of Jewish doctors. But Dad was the first Jew. Same thing with school teachers. My aunt Evelyn Copelman Davis, who was a school teacher, became a teacher about 1922-1923. She applied to the Arnold School District. They had never had a Jewish school teacher in either New Kensington or Arnold. Was she going to be employed? There was a question mark. She was employed, and subsequently her two sisters graduated, and she was employed, and then we had a number of Jewish teachers, including Ida Bell Miller, who was the shoe man, Davis Miller's daughter. But there was always this undercurrent that the Jews were different. Let's talk about the Hillcrest Country Club, which was the country club in Lower Borough. It was started in 1921. It was started by the townspeople and by Alcoa, because Alcoa needed a country club to attract its engineers and its scientists to come to New Kensington. So bonds were sold, and Alcoa bought half the bonds, and the townspeople put up the other half of the bonds. No Jews in the country club. The country club burnt down in 1950, and they decided, in the spirit of charity, that they should take in the Jews because they needed their money to build a new country club. So then the Jews were taken in. And in later years, Abe Blyer was put on the board of the country club and ultimately became the president of the country club. Abe Blyer was a Hungarian Jew who came to Pittsburgh when he was about 5 or 6 years old, went to Pitt Pharmacy School, came out to New Kensington to work for Charlie Lefkowitz, who had a drugstore here. Abe was a tall, handsome, very sleek guy, very smart guy, and was... So all of that is gone. But what happened to the Jewish community? Well, the Jewish community, in effect, is gone in New Kensington. And it mirrors the fact that Alcoa is gone in New Kensington. Alcoa does not employ anybody within the city limits of New Kensington, Arnold, or Lower Borough. Zero. Down from 1,600 scientists, 8,500 mill people and engineers. Alcoa did go to Merwin and build a new research center. I believe it was in the 70s. And they closed their research center on Freeport Road, which was where Bear Romero grazed his cows. And they now have about 600 or 700 scientists out there. Oddly enough, if you walk through those laboratories, you will see that half of the scientists are Asians today. And so the culture has changed. Alcoa closed its plant totally in New Kensington in about 1971 or 1972. And with it, slowly but surely, the old merchants died off. Their children had nothing to come back to New Kensington. So they moved on. They were doctors. They were lawyers. They were dentists. They moved to other parts of the country. They moved to Pittsburgh. They moved to Fox Chapel and so forth. So about 20 years ago, Bob Myers, who is still living, and who probably is the only other person alive that can talk to you about the history of the Jewish community in New Kensington. I understand Bob just recently moved to some assisted living place in the South Hills, and you might want to talk to Bob. Bob's family was one of the original families that came in the 1890s. They were in the furniture business. And as the town disintegrated, so did their business. They had two stores, one in New Kensington and one here in Natrona Heights. They closed their stores. His two brothers died, and he became the head of Israel Bonds in western Pennsylvania. Bob Myers came to me. Excuse me. Bob Myers came to me about 20 years ago, and he said to me, he said, Rabbi Dick, Y. Irving Dick, who was our rabbi at that time, has an idea. And he thinks that we should start a new synagogue in Fox Chapel. And he said, the reason for that is there are a couple of hundred unaffiliated Jewish people that live in Fox Chapel. And he's trying to also work out a deal with the B'nai Israel Synagogue on Negley Avenue in Pittsburgh. And we should go form a new synagogue in Fox Chapel. And he said, I'm here to enlist your support because, he said, we're going to need your help in several different ways to make this project work. So I said to Bob, and Bob was, because I've got the same office here that I had when I had my own office, same furniture, same everything. He was sitting right in that chair. I said, Bob, you're crazy. I said, why do we want to give up our synagogue? I said, your grandfather was one of the founders. My grandfather was one of the founders. I said, there is no way I'm going to go along with this. And I said, as a matter of fact, I'm going to oppose it. And I said, I'm going to defeat it. And he said, now, Jim, don't get so excited about this. He said, now, just have an open mind. And I said, well, you know, I always have an open mind. That's part of my legal training. He says, let me approach this from a different direction. He said, do you happen to have a synagogue directory? And I always keep my synagogue directory in this drawer, and here's a current synagogue directory. He said, go down the list of our members. And he said, keep in mind what their age is. And he said, you tell me 10 or 15 years from now, how many of those people are going to be living? And so I go down the list, and I'm aghast. I figured about 70 or 80% of them would be dead in that period of time. I said, you know, I never looked at it that way, Bob. And he said, so what are you going to do when we can no longer financially support a synagogue. He said, I know you'll give more money and more money as it's needed, but there's going to come a point where we're not going to be able to have a synagogue. And he said, what do you think's going to happen to you, all your family's memorial plaques and everything? So I shrugged my shoulders and I said, well, I guess I really don't know, Bob. And he said, well, if Beth Jacob closed, where would you go to synagogue? Oh, I said, I guess I'd go to Beth Sholem in Squirrel Hill. If I had to make a choice, I never really much thought about it. He said, now, isn't it going to be much better if we start a new synagogue in Fox Chapel, bring all these unaffiliated families in, and at the same time the B'nai Israel Synagogue, most all of the Jewish people had moved out of the east end of Pittsburgh and were living in Squirrel Hill, and that synagogue was sort of on the way down as well. And he said, if we can get, Rabbi Dick's dream is if we can get them and we can get the Beth Jacob people, we can form a synagogue in Fox Chapel. He said, we can take our memorabilia and our memorial plaques and everything, and we can have a synagogue. I said, you know what, Bob? I said, you're right, and I was wrong. I said, I'll sign on to the deal, and I'll support it. And he said to me, well, we're going to call a congregation meeting. I think I must have been on the board of directors at that time, but I can't remember. But he said, will you get up and speak in favor of it, number one, and would you guide us through what the steps would be to form a new synagogue? So I said, oh, sure, I'll do that. So the next thing is the congregation votes to do this, and the board of directors of Beth Jacob Synagogue votes to do this. So we have to find the location in the Fox Chapel area. So somebody from the synagogue goes to Howard Hanna and tells them that we need to have a location. Now, it was fortuitous that at the same time that Beth Jacob congregation and B'nai Israel congregation, I guess we had already formed the new congregation. It was called Adat Shalom B'nai Israel Beth Jacob. We kept the two old names, and we were incorporated already. And Paul Singer from Reed Smith, Sean McClay worked on it from the B'nai Israel Adat Shalom end, and I worked on it from the Beth Jacob end, and he's still a member of the congregation, and so am I. And Paul's a good man. So anyway, they're looking for a piece of real estate. Wouldn't you know, I'm vice chairman of the board of Harmerville Rehabilitation Center, which is now Health South, which was the largest rehabilitation hospital between New York and Chicago. And we did the residency in physical medicine for the Pitt Medical School and so forth. And we had bought, we meaning Harmerville, had bought a building that had been a Catholic school that was next door to us against my wishes. And Lee Lacey, who was our administrator at that time, he wanted this building. And most of the board listened to him and they didn't listen to me, so we bought this building. About 3 or 4 years later, it was excess real estate, and they gave the building to Howard Hanna to sell, and I figured, I got my last laugh. We're going to get rid of this building. They should have listened to me in the first place. We had, every year, we had a list of conflict of interest statement, being a board member of Harmerville, and that was a big operation. We employed 950 people. So, I would list the different organizations, companies whose board I was on or what have you, I never listed I was a board member of the Beth Jacob congregation. What could that possibly have to do with me being the vice chairman of the board of Harmerville Rehab, where we employ 900 and some people? Sure enough, don't they come? And whoever it was on the committee, they decide they want to buy this from Harmerville. I immediately have a conflict of interest. So I have to recuse myself as a board member. Oh, and the board member of the new synagogue, they took some from Beth Jacob, some from B'nai Israel, and some of the new people from Fox Chapel that were going to join the congregation. So I have to recuse myself from both the Harmerville board and the Beth Jacob board. So I had a friend who was the chairman of the board. We worked in consort. And there was one other Jewish woman who was on the board of the rehabilitation hospital. Her husband was a doctor in Pittsburgh, and I can't remember her name, because this was 20 years ago. And so everybody else on the board was a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and they lived in Fox Chapel. And most of them belonged to the Fox Chapel Golf Club, which at that time did not take Jews. So, and suddenly, Jews are going to have a presence in Fox Chapel. They're going to have a synagogue in Fox Chapel. So I said to my friend, I said, do you think the board's going to vote against this sale? I said, I can't even vote on it. I said, are they going to want a Jewish presence in Lily White Fox Chapel? And my friend just smiled, and he said, it will happen. That's all he said. And he made it happen, and there was no dissenting vote against the sale. Now, what did happen, and I couldn't say it, was that we paid $50,000 more than the bottom price that the hospitals was willing to sell it for, but I couldn't open my mouth because I was... So that is how Adat Shalom came to be. Now, part of the deal when we formed this new congregation is I said, for this to work, I said, the new congregation has to take over the Chevra Kedisha Cemetery. And what had happened was they thought that about 20 years before, Beth Jacob had taken over the Chevra Kedisha, but there were never any papers filed. So, and so we got court approval for the cemetery to be taken over by the new congregation. That was one of my jobs. And also, oddly enough, my mother was raised at 700 North Nagley, or 701 North Nagley Avenue, and they belonged to the B'nai Israel. So my grandparents from my mother's side are buried in the B'nai Israel. So both of those cemeteries are now owned by Adat Shalom B'nai Israel Beth Jacob. And and I think we have a very viable congregation. We have about 350 families. I long since quit the board of directors, although I support the synagogue financially. But as far as I know, I am the only Jewish member left in New Kensington, Arnold, and Lower Borough that belongs to Adat Shalom B'nai Israel Beth Jacob. We have some other Jews. I don't want to malign them, but I don't think they want to spend the money to belong. My wife and I are we're what they call founders. We have different levels of membership dues, and we're at the highest voluntary member. ship category for this reason. And I think it's important to note that Jews have a 3,000-year history. And whatever it is about Judaism, it has survived for 3,000 years. And I am not a particularly observant Jew, even though my grandfather was very frum and was yeshiva trained and all of these things. But I feel, but of course I follow the Ten Commandments, I try to be ethical, but I don't go to services every week or anything like that. I feel I am another link in the chain of Judaism. And I think I should do everything in my power, both financially and otherwise, to seal that link and make room for the next link in the chain. And that is why I am a Jew. That's why 3,000 years of my forebears have been Jews. And that is why, in spite of all the trouble that the Jewish people have had in the thousands of years, for some reason, Judaism has survived, and I think we present-day Jews have a duty to the next generation and the next generation to make it survive as well. So I've been talking for an hour and a half. I think I'll stop and let you ask questions.
Okay. I only have a few things here and there.
Turn that off for a minute.
So I wanted to ask you, you had alluded to this just now about observance at home growing up. Tell me a little bit about home life in that regard.
Well, we did not keep a kosher home. And well, my father grew up in an Orthodox home and my mother grew up in an Orthodox home, we did not keep a kosher home. We went to shul some Shabbats. I went with my mother. My father didn't go because he was too busy. My parents both respected the Jewish religion very much. But I really did not grow up in an environment, and my grandparents accepted that fact, that we did not keep kosher and so forth. But I was bar mitzvah, was confirmed from Sunday school. But we certainly were not from in our family.
Okay. Can you describe a little bit more about the family business, what you know of how it worked or where they got their inventory, things like that, if you can?
You mean my grandfather's business?
Yeah.
Or my father's medical business?
Well, the department store.
Okay, well, the department store, I guess my grandmother particularly worked real hard, and I think they were very financially successful. They sold both men's and women's clothing, shoes, yard goods, everything that a department store would sell except groceries. And the reason I think that they were fairly successful is because in 1914, my grandfather decided to make a pilgrimage to what was then Palestine and went by steamship to Palestine. And, in 1914, he had only been in this country 16 years, but he was wealthy enough to take this trip, left my grandmother home with the six kids, got stuck over there because the First World War broke out, then was there for a year, and my grandmother kept wiring him money. And he teamed up with a fella by the name of Professor Elliott, who was a professor at Harvard, later became the president of Harvard, and they traveled around the Mideast. And I have a picture of Mr. Elliott and my grandfather, Mr. Elliott on a donkey and my grandfather in front on a camel in front of the Sphinx in 1914. And my father made a big mistake. My father graduated from high school in 1914, and Mr. Elliott said to my grandfather, "You send your son to Harvard and I will make a man out of him. But my dad opted to go to Pitt instead. And, you know, the rest was history. But so I think, and then my grandmother, right after the war, went to Palestine again on her own. And she had been there as a girl when she was in Lithuania, because they took her older brother when he was 13 years old and left him with the chief rabbi in Jerusalem, and he was to train him to be a rabbi. I can't imagine taking a 13-year-old kid and leaving him. So they were all Sabras, that branch of the family. And but anyway, my grandmother went. Then they went some years later and took the grand tour of Europe, went to France, to Germany, to this, to that. So I only assume that they must have had money, because how could you be doing all this foreign traveling? And I presume they had a very successful business. My grandfather was on the board, the only Jew on the board of the bank. I have a feeling the only reason that happened is because he had a lot of money to put in the bank. But it was a general department store. And my father told me a story one time. The most popular children's shoes were Buster Brown shoes. And they sold Buster Brown in the New Kensington store. And I had other older people tell me they're all gone now. Buster Brown came to New Kensington, to their store, one Saturday. And they had a mob scene. They had to call the police. There were 3,000 or 4,000 people were trying to get in the store to buy Buster Brown shoes. But, you know, when you stop and think about it, isn't this a wonderful country? There's my grandfather, couldn't speak a word of English, comes over here, yeshiva trained. Thanks to my grandmother, they had successful businesses, educated their kids, and I have had a wonderful life. Most people, my father advised me when I got out of law school not to come back to New Kensington. It was clear that Alcoa was on the decline and that the town was going to be on the decline. He said, go somewhere where it's easier to grow, where the community is growing rather than it's dying. But I wanted to come back here. And I've had a happy life, and I've been engaged in the affairs of the community for 45 years. I've been very lucky that I've made a very good living. I enjoy teaching at the Pitt Law School. I enjoy the practice of law. And I worked for 70, 80 hours a week for 40-some years on the weekends and the evenings because I liked my work. And now I'm just over here at this firm, what that's called off counsel, where I'm basically a rainmaker for them. And I'm in at the law school one day a week, and I'm still having a good time. But you might look at New Kensington today, and downtown New Kensington, I have to be careful how I say this as a former solicitor and as a former board member of the Redevelopment Authority, but there is no viable business district in New Kensington or Arnold anymore. It's gone. And with that viable business district, the Jewish community is gone. But there's still a lot of pleasant memories.
Going back to the store, your grandfather was religious. Was the store open on Saturday?
Well, that's a very interesting question. All of the Jewish stores were open on Saturday. All of the Jewish stores closed for the high holidays and one day of Rosh Hashanah. We closed for 2 days, and we closed on Shabbos Tshuva. But they were open on Saturday. You had to. That was the main business thing.
Yeah. Did they come into Pittsburgh to buy inventory?
Yes, they did. They would go on Sundays to buy inventory, but their store was so large that they would go into Pittsburgh on Fifth Avenue where there was a lot of the wholesalers, but that was basically fill-in stuff. Most of the stuff they bought directly from the factories because they were so large. But an interesting story that my dad told me, I'm going to guess maybe it was around 1910, 19-something, there was a tremendous flood in Johnstown, not the one of 1889 where the dam broke. But my grandfather, I guess being the entrepreneur that he was, I think pushed by my grandmother, because my grandfather was just interested in religious things. He was a great Zionist. He was always raising money for Israel and everything. Anyway, he went as far as he could to Johnstown on the train, and then we couldn't go any further. He got a farmer with a couple of mules, and he went into Johnstown, and this Arnold Traffic store that he had bought out, there was a Penn Traffic company in Johnstown, and somebody told me they're still in business. But anyway, he went in there, and he bought as much flood distress merchandise as he could, like underwear and stuff like that, loaded them up on the mules, went back to the train, loaded them on the train and brought them back and had a big sale where he was selling underwear for like 2 cents that he had paid 1 cent for, you know? So, you know, that was that.
What happened to the store?
Well, what happened was the Depression came along, and at the same time, my grandfather got glaucoma, and there was no good treatment for that. And my grandmother had hypertension, and so in 1933, they just had a big going out of business sale. They kept the real estate, and they rented the real estate, and eventually there's a furniture store in there now in Arnold. They sold it to a predecessor who had a furniture store there. And I think it's interesting to note in my family and most of the early Jewish families, because in Europe, a lot of places they were prohibited from owning real estate. A lot of the Jews bought a lot of downtown real estate. And my grandfather, I knew lots of properties that he bought, but I don't know of any properties he ever sold. And they didn't sell the stuff till my grandfather had died, or he spent his last few years in those days what was called the Jewish Home for the Aged. It's the Robert Morris Home now.
Yeah.
Because he had glaucoma, and he was in Pittsburgh raising money for the Zionists, and he stepped off a curb. He didn't see a car, and he was hit, and they broke his legs, and they never healed upright. So he could daven every day. He went to the Jewish Home for the Aged, and he walked with crutches and a wheelchair, but he went every day. They had a minyan, and the food was kosher and everything, so that's where he spent his last days.
What happened to the actual synagogue building?
Okay, that's an interesting story. I wanted to mention that. So that building to reproduce today, I wanted to talk about that, would probably cost $1 million to reproduce. What we did when we took this ex-Catholic school from Harmerville, we had stained glass windows on the balcony of the synagogue. We incorporated all of those stained glass windows into the sanctuary of the Fox Chapel Synagogue. If you go in there, you'll see on both sides there are probably 6 stained glass windows on both the north side and the south side of the synagogue. Those all came from the Beth Jacob Synagogue, and they really look nice. So I gave the synagogue to a realtor to sell, and the thing was for sale for like two or three or 4 years. And the other thing was, as time went on, there was no parking where the synagogue was. No parking at all. And I think we ended up, we were all the way down to $200,000 for the synagogue. And we were starting to have problems. The roof would start to leak. We had to spend $10,000 to fix the roof. The furnace would break. We had, and it really became a white elephant. So one day one of our congregants said to me, would you consider giving away the synagogue? And by that time, I was really starting to worry. I mean, it was just sucking up money, and we were getting no return for the thing. And I said, well, to whom? And he said, there's a very nice African-American minister who has a PhD. His name is the Reverend Mitch Nichols. And he said, he's a friend of mine, and he could really use the synagogue. And I said, well, I said, we'll take the rest of our religious things out so there's no, you know, religious things on the Bima and so on and so forth. So I called a meeting. We had a property committee of the board of directors of Beth Jacob, and I think I was like the chairman of the property committee. And I said to him, I said, I think we better just give this thing away and get out from under, because we're going to eat up all our money. Because we had an endowment from the cemetery, and we had an endowment from the synagogue. And I think altogether between the two, we brought about $500,000 to the table, to the new synagogue, as I recall, as the years go on. My memory gets shabbier. But so we decided to give the building to this Reverend Mitch Nichols. I don't remember the name of his congregation. He's still around, though.
In the building.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think it's a good use, and I think we did the right thing. I'm sure there are people that can disagree, but I'm comfortable with the decision.
You had mentioned the Jewish Club.
Yeah.
Were there any other Jewish organizations, a B'nai B'rith or an AZA?
Yeah, we had all of that. We had a B'nai B'rith, we had a Sisterhood, we had an AZA.
What was it like for Jewish kids growing up?
When I grew up, the generation before me, there were more Jewish kids, and they had a basketball team, and they had different things. When I grew up, there weren't that many from my generation. So, I mean, there weren't enough of us that we just socialized with the Jewish kids. We all socialized, you know, I dated the Gentile kids because there weren't enough. I think in my class there might have been two Jewish girls in my high school class, so 400, and I won't comment on their looks, but we all just sort of, you know, but we knew that's all right to date, but you don't marry. that was the, and interestingly enough, if you look back at 100 years of the Jewish community in New Kensington, we were way statistically overrepresented in bachelors. And I think the reason that was is because it was forbidden to marry a non-Jewish woman, and there weren't enough Jewish women around. Now, this Lou Klaster that I mentioned, who was, did I tell you he was from the class of 1916 at Pitt Law School? I don't know if I mentioned that or not.
He
was the first Jewish lawyer. My dad was the first Jewish doctor. Lou Klaster.
Was Isaac's son?
Isaac's son, and he was the first Jewish lawyer. Class of 1916 from Pitt. He never married. He went with a Miss Burns for 35 years. But he never married. And I can name you so many other ones that never married. Because they just weren't that many. And they didn't get to Pittsburgh very often to meet other Jewish women. We had a whole bunch of bachelors here. And that was before we knew about being gay. Believe me, none of them were gay.
Yeah.
Not that there's anything the matter with being gay, but I mean, I'm, you know. But it's sociologically, it's
interesting.
It's interesting to note that. But just as Alcoa is dead today, the Jewish community in New Kensington is dead. I mean, you're looking at the Jewish community in New Kensington. And that's sad, but in another sense, you know, Jews are, by their nature, aggressive, and I think they want the best for their families, and there's nothing here anymore. There's nothing here. So it becomes an interesting... the Jewish community in New Kensington, I would describe as an interesting footnote to history. That is no more.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.